From Altiplano to Comus Station, Esme traveled by civilian carrier, a regularly scheduled passenger ship. In the 30 days of her leave, other news had come to dominate the screens. No one seemed to recognize her in her civilian clothes, for which she was grateful. She divided her time between her own quarters and the ship's palatial fitness equipment. It felt odd to be aboard a ship and have no duties, but she was not about to call attention to herself by hanging around the crew looking wistful. Better to sweat on the exercise machines and then cool off in the pool. She was vaguely aware that some of the other passengers who regularly used the fitness equipment might have wanted to chat, but swimming steady laps made that difficult. In her quarters, she worked her way through one teaching cube after another, everything in the ship's library that seemed relevant. At Comus, she chose to walk the distance from the liner's docking bay to Fleet Gate rather than taking a slideway. She needed to do a bit of shopping. She wanted to replace every bit of clothing she'd brought from Altiplano. It was wasteful, she admitted, to throw away perfectly good garments, but she wanted nothing to connect her to her past. When she found a Space Relief outlet store, she emptied her cases and then handed over the cases, all but her fleet duffel. She needed little, really. A few comfortable things for lounging, one good dress outfit. She found all that in the first store she entered, picking the things hastily. It didn't really matter what she wore when she was off duty. She was eager to get back to fleet territory.
Welcome home, Lieutenant.
When she arrived at the fleet gate, the sentry's cheerful greeting sent her mood up three notches. Esme found her new assignment posted to her private mail when she checked in. She had expected a tour on Comus itself. Else why send her out here in the first place? But her orders directed her to Sierra Station, there to take up her duties with the 14th Heavy Maintenance Yard aboard the Kosciusko. She'd never heard of that ship. When she looked it up in the table of ships, she discovered that it was a DSR, a deep space repair ship, part of the second wave deployment out of Sierra Station. Someone must be seriously annoyed with her. Repair ships were huge, ungainly, complicated, and totally unglamorous. Worse, DSR ships were a logistics nightmare, the natural and lawful prey of every inspector general. It was impossible to keep them in perfect order, up to nominal inventory, because they were always losing parts to some other vessel. Legitimately, but inevitably, the paperwork lagged reality. Young officers considered assignment to a DSR proof that someone was down on them. Esme took it as evidence that exoneration by the official court hadn't convinced someone of her innocence. She looked up the next available transfer to Sierra Station. Because she had arrived on Comus almost 24 hours before her leave was up, she could just catch a fleet supply run to Sierra, and she had no good excuse not to catch it, since her duty status went active the moment she logged on to pick up her orders. Esme checked. The supply ship had space available, and she had 2 hours to report aboard. She dashed in and out of the tiny PX to pick up her new insignia. Her promotion to lieutenant had come through while she was on leave, and get a Kosciusko ship tag for her duffel. That wasn't required, since she hadn't signed aboard, but her duffel was more likely to arrive there if it had a ship tag than a name and number. When she got to the docking bay for the supply ship, she found herself in a queue with half a dozen other fleet personnel making a transfer. No one stared at her. No one seemed to know who she was or care. Most of the talk was about a parpon match played recently between the crews of two ships in dock. Apparently, someone had kicked all three of the possible goals in one play, but Esme had never really understood parpon. Why two balls? Why three differently colored goals? Why, she often thought to herself but would not say, bother? Now she was glad to hear the others full of enthusiasm for something that banal, and she hoped that her moment of fame had already vanished. The supply ship was hauling parts that would resupply Kosciusko. Its exec had noticed her orders and put her to work checking inventory. Esme would spend 16 days counting impellers, gaskets, lengths of tubing, fasteners of all kinds, tubes of adhesive, and logging updates to repair manuals, both hard copy and cubes.
Someone at headquarters really hates me.
Esme was good at this kind of thing. She didn't find it difficult to keep her concentration. On the fourth day, she noticed that of the 562 boxes supposed to contain 85mm star slot fasteners with threads of pitch 1/10 and interval 3mm, one was labeled for 85mm star slot fasteners with threads of pitch 1/12 and interval 4mm instead. 2 days later, she found three leaky tubes of adhesive, which had glued themselves to neighboring tubes in a container. It was clear from the discoloration of the labels that they had been flawed from the beginning. She noted that. She could see why this was necessary. Someone would find the errors, and better now than in the midst of an emergency repair. But it wasn't the glamorous sort of job she'd thought of when she had dreamed of leaving Altiplano. Either time she'd left Altiplano. She wondered if she'd spend her entire time aboard Kosciusko doing the same thing. That would make a very long 2 years. She didn't want notoriety, exactly, but she would like something more interesting than bean counting. In her off shift, she listened to the sports fans, hoping for a change in topic, but they seemed to have no other interests. Apparently, they had all played on a Parpon team at one time or another, and after they'd rehashed the recent match, they were happy to tell each other in detail about every match they'd played. Esme listened long enough to understand at last what the rules were and why two balls, each team had its own ball and scores could be made with the opponent's ball only on the third neutral goal. It still seemed an unreasonably complex game, and as boring as any other for non-players to listen to. She finally gave up and started reading the supply ship's tech support cubes. Inventory control, principles in practice. The design of automated inventory systems. She decided that even an article on static munitions recognition systems, which she couldn't imagine needing, was better than the 88th rehash of a game she hadn't seen and didn't care about anyway. She was sure she'd never come face-to-face with a Borowski V-845 mine or its nastier cousin, the Smetig Series G. But she stared at the display until she was sure she would know them again if she were unlucky enough to see one. Sierra Station served both fleet and civilian interests, but fleet predominated. Two long arms docked only military vessels. Esme watched the name scroll past on the wardroom screen. Pachyderm, the oldest active cruiser and fleet's largest. Plenitude, Savage, and Vengeance, cruisers much like Harris Serrano's Vigilance. Plenitude had a star by its name. It was the flagship of some combat group. A gaggle of patrol craft, Consummate, Terraphil, Singularity, Autarch, Rascal, Runagate, Vixen, Despite.
Despite? What is Despite doing here?
Esme felt cold all over. She had left that very lucky and unlucky ship almost the full length of familiar space away. She had not expected to see Despite again unless she was transferred to its sector.
Why did they move it at all? And why, of all places, here?
She didn't want to know. She didn't want to see that ship again. The memory of victory could not erase the memory of what had gone before, that bloody mutiny and the mistakes she had made later. Esme shook that off. She couldn't afford to be upset by it, and it was unlikely she'd have anything to do with Despite and her new captain. Kosciusko, the screen read, blinking now because she had put a tracer on the name. She noted the concourse and docking number in her personal compad. One corner of the screen turned yellow, then flashed their arrival dock number in blue. Esme referred to the station map. Kosciusko was out at the far end of the longest arm, but she could get there without going past Despite. When she made it to the gate area, a pair of fleet security personnel checked her orders again. To her surprise, they made no move to open the access hatch.
It'll be a few minutes, Lieutenant.
One of them had sergeant stripes on his uniform, and his unit patch read Sierra Station, not Kosciusko. Esme noted that nowhere on the deck of the gate area were the traditional stripes defining ship space from station space.
They've sent a pod, but it's not here yet.
A pod?
From the expression on his face, Esme had the feeling she had just asked a stupid question.
DSRs don't actually dock at stations. They're too big. The relative masses would play havoc with each other's artificial gravity. Would you like to see Kosciuszko, Lieutenant?
Yes, thank you.
Esme had already shown she was ignorant. She might as well learn what she could.
Here, then.
Up on the gate display came a blurry view of something large. The view sharpened, leaped nearer, and finally stabilized as the biggest and most unlikely excuse for a ship Esme had ever seen. It looked like the unfortunate mating of an office building with a bulk cargo tank and some sort of clamshell array.
Those funny-looking things are on the main repair bays. They've got them open now, testing. As you can see, an escort can fit all the way in, and even most patrols. Then the ports swing down.
That opening is the size of an escort?
Esme revised her assumptions about size upward steeply. Not just an office building, but she realized that the array of lights beyond a rounded bulge was another office building. It looked nothing like the DSR stats she'd seen at the Academy 6 years before. The two DSRs they'd been shown designs of had been built like clusters of grapes, with a single cylindrical repair bay running through the cluster.
It doesn't look anything like the DSRs I saw specs for at the Academy.
Kosciuszko wasn't commissioned then. She's new, and she's not the same as she was either. Here, I'll show you a design plot.
This came up in three standard views, plus an angled one similar to that Esme had seen. In design, the DSR still looked like several disparate but large components had been squashed together. Five blunt arms ran out from a central core. That was the office building part. Two adjacent arms had the clamshell arrangements on them. Behind those trailed great oblong shapes, labeled drive test cradle. The arm adjacent to neither main repair bay had the tank-like object, larger, Esme realized, than any tank she'd seen, stuck on its end like a bulbous nose. Without the tank, it would have looked like an orbital station specialized for some industrial process.
What is that tank?
Dunno, sir. That was added about 3 years ago, maybe 2 years after she was commissioned. Ah, here's your pod.
The display blinked out, then reappeared as a status line. Finally, the status light turned green, and the sergeant opened the hatch.
Good luck, sir. Hope you enjoy your tour.
Esme found the pod unsettling. It had no artificial gravity. She had to strap into the passenger racks and hang there facing a ring of ports. The pilot wore an EVA suit. His helmet hung on a drop ring just above him, suggesting that the EVA suit was more sense than worry. Through the pod's wide ports, she could see entirely too much of Sierra Station and its docked vessels, barnacles on a floating wheel. Station hulls of pressurized bulk cargo tanks, gleaming from brightly colored commercial liners, and scarcely revealing the matte dark hulls of fleet vessels, except for pricks of light reflected from shield and weapons fittings. Beyond, a star field with no planets distinguishable. Sierra System had them, but not out here, where the station served primarily out-system transport. Sudden acceleration bumped Esme against the rack and then ceased. Her stomach lagged behind, then lurched forward.
Bag's on the overhead if you need it.
Esme gulped and kept her last meal firmly in place.
We're over there.
The pod pilot nodded to the forward port, a tangle of lights that diverged as they came nearer. Suddenly, a glare as a searchlight from one arm flared across another, revealing the hull surface to be lumpy and dark. And big. Esme could not get used to the scale.
Passenger pod docking access is near the hub. That gives passengers the easiest access to personnel lifts and most admin offices. Cargo shuttles and special cargo pods dock near the inventory bays for the specific cargo. Minimizes interior traffic.
The pilot leaned forward and prodded the control panel. Deceleration shoved Esme against the straps. Closer, closer. She glanced up to the overhead port and saw the vast bulk of the DSR blocking out most of the starfield, then all of it. Exiting the pod into the passenger bay, Esme stepped across the red stripes that signaled where the ship formally began, something that had no relation to its architecture, and saluted the colors painted on the opposite bulkhead. The sergeant at the dock entry looked back and forth from her ID to her face several times.
Lieutenant Suiza. Welcome home, sir. The captain left word he wanted to see you when you came aboard. Shall I call ahead?
Thank you. Can you tell me my bunk assignment?
Yes, sir. You've got number 14 in the junior officers section of T2, cross ship from where we are now. This is the base of T4. Do you want someone to take your duffel down?
No, thanks. I'll just stick it in a temp locker for now.
It's no trouble, Lieutenant. The temp lockers are out of your way to the captain's office anyway.
Thanks, then.
Esme handed over the duffel and accepted the sergeant's directions to the captain's office. Turn left out that hatch, take the second lift up 5 levels to deck 9, then left out of the lift and follow the signs. The wide curving corridor matched the size of the ship. It belonged on an orbital station, not a warship. Esme passed the first bank of lift tubes. The signs made it clear she was on deck 4, which on an ordinary ship would be main. Not that any ordinary ship would have signs. At the second bank of tubes, she stepped in and watched the numbers flash by.
18 decks? What did they put on 18 decks?
Esme stepped out of the lift tube on deck 9. Here, the wide curving corridor that went around the core had the gray tile she associated with main deck in ordinary ships. Across from the lift tube openings, a corridor led away, she supposed, down one of the arms. T5, said the sign on the overhead. A clerk sat at a desk in an open bay to one side.
Ah, Lieutenant Sweezer. Yes, sir, the captain wanted to see you right away. Captain Vladis Julian Haken, sir. Just let me buzz the captain.
Esme could not hear any signal, but the clerk nodded.
Go along in, sir. Third on your left.
This captain had had a wooden door substituted for the standard steel hatch. This was not unusual. It was somewhat unusual for it to be closed when a visitor had been announced.
Come in!
Esme opened the door and entered, to find herself facing the top of a gray head. The captain's office had been carpeted in deep green and paneled in wood veneer. The familiar seal hung on the bulkhead behind the captain's desk on one side, and a framed copy of some document, probably his commission, though she couldn't see it, on the other.
Ah, Lieutenant Sweezer.
That seemed to be the greeting of the day. In Captain Haken's tone of voice, it sounded more like a curse than a greeting.
I hear they consider you quite the hero on Altiplano.
Local interest, sir. That's all.
I'm glad you realize that.
Yes, sir.
Captain Haken looked up suddenly, as if hoping to catch her in some incriminating expression. Esme met his gaze calmly. She had expected repercussions from the awards ceremony. That was only natural. His gaze flicked down to her uniform, where the silver and gold ribbon was not on the row allotted to non-fleet decorations. By law, she was entitled to wear major awards from any political system within the Familius Regnant. By custom, no one did, unless on a diplomatic assignment, where the failure to wear a locally awarded decoration might insult the giver. Junior officers, in particular, wore no personal awards except when in full dress uniform. So Esme had the S&S, the ships and service ribbons appropriate to her past service, including the 2 decorations awarded to Spite's crew for the recent engagement, and, incongruously, the Ship Efficiency Award won under the late Captain Hearn. Traitor Hearn might have been, but her ship had topped the sector in the IG's inspection. Haken's gaze flicked back to hers.
Some captains would be concerned about a junior officer who had been involved in a mutiny, no matter how warranted the action was later shown to be.
I'm sure that's true, sir. There must be some officers who remain concerned even after a court has considered the matter in detail. I can assure the captain that I will not overreact to such concern if anyone expresses it.
You seem very sure of yourself, Lieutenant. How do you know that I'm not one of those so concerned?
Idiot.
His determination to prick her had overcome his good sense. No answer she could give would entirely ease the tension he had created.
Is the captain concerned?
About many things, Lieutenant, of which your potential for mutiny is only one minute particle. I have been assured by those who are supposed to know that the public reports of your court-martial were in fact accurate, that there is no suspicion of your having conspired to mutiny ahead of your captain's treacherous act.
Haken waited. Esme could think of nothing helpful to say.
I shall expect your loyalty, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir.
And have you no corresponding concern that your next captain might also be a traitor? That I might be in the pay of some enemy?
No, sir. Captain Hearn must have been an aberration.
And the others as well? You're happier than I, if you believe that, Lieutenant. We've had investigators all over every ship in the fleet, and that's reassuring only to those who think the investigators can't be bent. A mess of trouble that Serrano woman caused.
Esme opened her mouth to defend Harris Serrano, and realized it would do no good. If Haken seriously believed that Serrano had caused trouble by unmasking traitors and saving the Familius from invasion, she couldn't change his mind. She could only ruin her own reputation.
Not that she isn't a brilliant commander. I suppose Fleet must count itself lucky to have her back on active status, if we do get into war. I'm told Admiral Vida Serrano is pleased with you. I suppose she would be, since you saved her niece's neck.
That, too, was unanswerable. Esme wished he would get to the point, if his point was not merely to needle her, trying to get some sort of reaction.
I hope you don't have a swelled head from all the attention, Lieutenant, or some kind of psychological trauma from the strain of the court-martial, which I've been warned is sometimes the case, even with a favorable verdict.
No, sir.
Good. I'm sure you're aware that this is a time of crisis for both the fleet and the Familius. No one knows quite what to expect, except that on this ship, I expect everyone to attend to duty. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Very good, Lieutenant. I'll see you from time to time as the mess rotations come around.
He dismissed her with a nod. Esme went out trying to suppress a resentment that she knew would do her no good. No one lasted long in any service with a why-me attitude. In the history of the universe, Papa Stefan had taught them all, life was unfair more often than not. Life wasn't about fair. What it was about had filled more than one evening with explosive argument. Esme handed her order chip to the clerk in the front office.
What's my duty assignment? Do you know?
That's the 14th Heavy Maintenance Yard, Lieutenant. Admiral Dossignol's command. You'll need to report to his admin section. Here.
He sketched out a route on her compad.
Just keep going clockwise around the core, and you'll come to it at the base of T3.
Is the bridge on this deck?
No, sir. The bridge is up on 17. The ship's too big for the usual color codes. There is a system, but it's not standard. We call this command deck because all the commands have their headquarters units here. That's just for convenience, really. It cuts down the transit time.
Esme could imagine that in a ship this size, any hand-carried message could take a while to arrive. She had never been on a ship where the captain's office and the bridge were not near each other. On her way around the core, she passed another obvious headquarters, this one with a neat sign informing her that it was the Sector 14 Training Command, Admiral Levati commanding. Underneath were smaller signs. Senior Technical School's Admin Office, Senior Technical School's Assessment, Support Systems. She walked on, past the base of another wing, this one labeled T2. That was where she would be living, but she didn't have time to explore it now. On and on. And there ahead, she saw a large banner proclaiming 14th Heavy Maintenance Yard. The scrap will rise again. Below that, smaller signs directed the ignorant to the administrative offices. There, a bright-eyed pivot major sent her directly to the Admiral's Chief of Staff, Commander Adarin. He greeted Esme's appearance in a matter-of-fact way she found reassuring. He had already read her report on the inventory aboard the supply ship and seemed far more interested in that than her past.
We've been trying to nail our supplier on those leaky adhesive tubes for a couple of years, but we couldn't prove that the supplies were damaged before we got here. I'm glad old Scory, the XO on that supply ship, thought of having you go over the stock on your way here. We may finally get some leverage on him.
Yes, sir.
How much experience do you have with inventory control?
None, sir.
I'm impressed, then. Especially that you caught those fasteners. Most people give up after 50 or 60 items, or assume the computer will catch it. It's supposed to, of course. There's supposed to be automatic labeling right from the manufacturing machinery. Zero error, they keep claiming. Never have seen zero errors, though. Of course, could be someone from the IG's office putting little tests in our path to see if we're alert.
That possibility hadn't occurred to Esme, though sabotage had. But he hadn't been on despite.
Of course, it could also be enemy action, but I'd rather believe in stupidity than malice. Now, let's see. Your last duty was on a patrol craft. Your emphasis on your last few cruises was scan technology. Frankly, we have plenty of scan tech experts aboard now, all more experienced than you in the field. Would do you good to branch out, get some expertise in other ship systems.
Fine, sir.
Esme hoped it was fine. She knew she needed to learn about other systems, but was he just determined to keep her away from Scan because Scan was political?
Good. I expect most of you juniors think DSR is a bad assignment, but you'll discover that there's no better way to learn what really keeps ships operational. If you take advantage of it, this tour can teach you a lot.
Yes, sir.
Well, I'm going to assign you to H&A first. Hull and architecture, that is. You'll find it a lot more complicated than your basic course at the Academy.
I expect so, sir.
You'll be working with Major Patak. She's on Deck 8, Portside Main, aft third of T4. You can ask someone from there. Had time to stow your gear yet?
No, sir.
Well, technically you're not on duty until tomorrow, but...
I'll go see Major Patak, sir.
Good. Now, the Admiral will want to meet you, but he's tied up right now in a meeting, and I don't expect he'll be free until tomorrow or the next day. Check back with me and I'll set that up.
Yes, sir.
Esme headed clockwise from T3, where the 14th Heavy Maintenance had its administrative offices, to T4. Sure that she had now caught on to the Kosciusko's peculiar structure. At the hub end of T4, she found an array of personnel and cargo transport tubes and took the personnel lift down to the 8th deck. There, she faced an axial passage wide enough for three horsemen abreast and plunged into it, looking for the third crosswise passage. She passed one administrative office after another, each occupied by busy clerks. Communication systems, weapon systems, remote imaging systems, but nothing labeled Hull and architecture. Finally, she stopped.
Excuse me, I'm looking for Hull and architecture?
Hull and architecture? That's on the port side main passage, sir. You'll have to go back to the hub and clockwise to it.
Surely there are cross passages?
No, sir. T4 has one of the main repair bays. Nothing goes straight across at this level from deck 3 up to deck 15.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
No problem, sir. It takes a while for anyone to get used to this place. Just take this passage back, turn left, then look for the P designations on the bulkheads. That's port side main. If you keep going, you'll get to Portside Secondary, which you don't want. Hull and architecture is about as far down Portside Main as we are down starboard, so...
So she had given herself a lot more walk than she wanted.
Thank you.
This ship shouldn't need any fitness equipment if everyone got lost occasionally. Although Esme felt the length of the hike in her legs, she had no more trouble finding Patak's office. The portside main passage was easy enough, and at the third passage aft, she found a pivot who directed her the rest of the way. Major Patak wasn't in that office. Esme glanced up and down the passage. Crewmen moved along as if they knew what they were doing, and no Major. She thought of going to look, and decided not to play that game. She would simply park here until Patak came back. Esme glanced around. On the bulkhead facing the entrance was a display of metal pieces. Esme wondered what it was and moved closer to read the label below. Common welding errors, it said. Esme could see the big lopsided blob at the one joint and the failure of another blob to cover the joint. But what was wrong with the rest of them?
So, you're my new assistant.
Esme turned around. Major Patak looked like her name sounded. A short, angular woman with a narrow face that reminded Esme uneasily of a mule.
Sir.
And no background at all in naval architecture or heavy engineering, I notice.
No, sir.
Do you at least have some background in construction of anything? Even a chicken house?
It was clear that Patak was furious about something. Esme hoped it wasn't her own presence.
Not unless helping put a roof back on a stable after a windstorm counts.
No, it doesn't. Someone must be mad at both of us, Lieutenant. Sector HQ stole three of my best H&A specialists, promoted my assistant off the ship, and left me short, and now they've sent you, whatever your background is.
Scan, mostly.
If I were religious, I would consign their sorry butts to some strenuous afterlife. Blast it. I never can stay mad long enough to singe them properly, and they know it. All right, Lieutenant, let's see what you do know. Whatever it is, it's not enough, but at least you haven't done anything stupid yet.
I've hardly had time, sir.
Patak moved to her desk, where she yanked at a drawer without effect.
There's a naive statement. I've been sent idiots who managed to screw up before I've met them. Oh! For instance, this drawer. It never has worked right since your predecessor, times two, thought it would be clever to rekey the lock. We still don't know what he did, but none of the command wands work on it, nor does anything else but brute force and profanity. Piece of shit, goddamn son of a bitch and bastard! Ah!
Esme wanted to ask why anyone would use such a pesky drawer, but this was not the time. She watched Patak rummage through the contents, coming up with a couple of data cubes.
You probably wonder why I put anything in here. Frankly, so do I. But there's little enough secured storage down here, not with all the specialists we have aboard. People who know all the tricks of every security device since the latch. They sent me some background on you, but I haven't looked at it yet, which I hope you won't hold against me.
No, sir.
For God's sake, Lieutenant, loosen up. Find a seat somewhere. Let's see here.
Patak inserted the cube in a cube reader as Esme looked around for something to sit on. Every horizontal surface was crusted in clutter. The two chairs had piles of hard copy that looked like inventory lists.
Just shove some of that onto the floor. Danton was supposed to clean it up yesterday, but he's in sick bay with some cruddy caught. I think we'd do better to let them brew their nasty chemicals on board. They always get sick ashore.
Esme set a pile of paper carefully on the floor and sat down. Patak was scowling at the cube reader's display.
Well, for a mutineer and a hero, you're awfully quiet, Lieutenant Sweeza. Trying to cover your tracks? The strong silent type. Not mine, as you've already discovered. Planetary militia family. Ye gods, one of those Sweezas.
Esme hadn't had that reaction from anyone in Fleet before. Patak stared at her.
Do they know?
I'm not sure what you mean, sir.
Don't play games with me, Lieutenant Sweeza. I mean, does Fleet understand that planetary militia is an understatement when applied to the Sweeza family of Altiplano?
I had assumed they did. At least when I applied, there was a background check, and surely they found out.
You're a careful pup. I noticed that had. What do you think now?
Most don't realize it, but I presume someone must.
I see.
Patak scrolled through the cube contents. Esme presumed it was a précis of her record.
Interesting place, Altiplano. But I wouldn't want to live there. Ah, at least you were on the science branch at the academy. Interesting. You didn't take the usual courses for someone going command track. What did you think? Technical?
Yes, sir.
And then you end up the most junior officer ever to command a patrol vessel in combat. And win. I'll bet someone's looking into your background again. Well, I'll tell you what, Lieutenant. The most important thing you can do right now is learn your way around this ship. Because when I have something for you to do, I don't want you to spend an hour finding out where it is. So, next 3 days, while we're docked, go everywhere and see everything and be ready for an orientation exam when you come back. That's 0800 on the 27th. Clear?
Yes, sir. If the Major doesn't mind, how did you know about Altiplano?
Good for you. I was wondering if you'd get up the nerve to ask. I met a fellow one time I thought of hitching up with back when I was a jig and things weren't going too well. Spent a leave on Altiplano with his family. Heard all about the Sweezes and their relations and the local politics. But the whole time he was extolling the beauties of those big rolling plains and snow-capped mountains, I was wishing for a nice, tight spaceship. Especially after a gallop over the plains in a rainstorm, I was sure I'd be fried by lightning. And I was so sore I couldn't walk for days. I suppose you ride?
When I have to. It's expected, riding. But I chose space.
My kind of woman. Now get out of here and start learning where things are. Warn you, my exams are no joke. Here, this is what you need.
Patak tossed over a data cube.
That and good legs.
Thank you, sir.
0800 on the 27th.
Yes, sir.
Esme paused, but the Major didn't look up. She retraced her way back to the hub corridors, then looked up her assigned quarters and figured out a route to that compartment. T2 should be back the way she'd come, counterclockwise, then up the personnel lift, and she paid close attention to the axial passage designation, even though T2 wasn't split by a repair bay. Somewhere around here, her compartment was small, but her own. Lieutenants had that bit of privacy. Her duffel was waiting on the bunk, its seals unbroken. She stowed her gear in the locker, activated the status board, and confirmed her identity to the computer's inquiry. On a bulkhead, a colored plan explained the officer housing arrangement. T2 was configured for personnel housing, decks of enlisted bunking, broken into large bays for most, with two- or four-person compartments for the most senior. An entire deck for junior officers, with ensigns in 10-man bays, jigs in two-person compartments, and lieutenants in separate compartments, ranging outward by seniority. Above her was a deck of billeting for field-grade officers, and above that, a deck for the flag officers. She blinked at the number of admirals aboard. Messing was in the same wing, two levels of food storage, kitchens, and dining halls. Exercise rooms, gyms, pools, even team sports space. She shuddered at the thought of more parpon enthusiasts. And on the top decks, open gardens.
Gardens?
Some space stations had gardens, but no fleet vessel she'd ever been on. She thanked whatever beneficent deities had not assigned her to environmental. It must be unbelievably difficult on a ship like this. She looked around her compartment again. She hadn't minded ensign bunking when she'd been that junior. Some automatic device in her brain kept the worst dreams away when she was sleeping in a public space. Lack of privacy when awake had rarely bothered her either. She had not had much free time to miss it. Now she would have to hope that the nightmares didn't wake her neighbors on either side. Her conscience pointed out that she could always go to medical and request help from the psychs. She ignored it. She had no messages waiting. She was not expected anywhere in particular. Which meant she could take a look at Patak's assignment on the cube if she could find a cube reader free. The console informed her that she had her own cube reader. It took her a moment to find it. She had never seen one in the fully stowed position. Most people left them half open at least for the next user. The cube contained what looked like ordinary ship schematics. Not ordinary exactly. This ship wasn't ordinary. But nothing she couldn't have pulled off the general user base and displayed on her own console. Esme called up the schematics on the console to check that. Not quite the same. Passages that went through on one schematic dead-ended in the other. Lifts were in slightly different places. Esme scowled at the display.
Is the Major trying to play me for a fool, or is the ship's own database wrong? If so, why?
She looked for the nearest non-match, which was back on T3, where a cross corridor on Deck 3 that the ship's database said ran through Forming Workshop 2B ended on Patak's data cube before reaching the workshop. According to her data, Forming Workshop 2B couldn't be reached except by a detour around dye storage. Only one way to find out. She glanced at the time. She could get up there and back to her assigned mess in T2 before the next meal. Back to the hub end of T2, then clockwise to the base of T3. She was getting the hang of this. She located the personnel lift tube beside a cluster of four labeled Cargo Only. The personnel lift light changed to green, and Esme punched in. When the second light came on, she stepped in and felt a quick double lurch of her innards before she came to rest at the hatch 8 decks down. Waiting there was another lieutenant, male, with a couple of ensigns in tow.
I don't know you. Are you assigned here?
Esme hoped she didn't have the bug-eyed look that usually followed a short hop on the lift tube.
Just aboard, sir. Esme Sweeza, assigned to Hull and Architecture.
Oh, yes.
He extended a hand. He had a good handshake.
Ty Galanifer. Short for something horrible and familial. Don't ask. I heard you were coming. I'm with 14th Maintenance Staff. Are you busy at the moment?
I'm assigned to Major Patak.
Yep, you're busy. I'm not surprised she's already got you running all over the ship. But meet these two, also newbies. Ensigns Anson and Partrade.
The two ensigns returned Esme's handshakes. Anson had a chilly, damp palm, and Partrade's felt as if he'd lined it with saddle leather.
See you at mess. Come on, guys. Down the tube we go.
Esme turned away and looked around her. She needed the starboard main axial passage for T3. On this deck, the corridor was wide enough to drive a small truck through, and the inlaid guidelines for transport carts, along with marked pedestrian lanes on either side, suggested that small trucks did in fact drive it, at speed. Esme glanced back and saw a flatbed carrier loaded with canisters rolling smoothly along the guideline, its red sensor blinking like a mad red eye. Ahead, Esme saw it slow and swing into a large hatch on the outboard side. When she got to the hatch and looked in, she saw a long robotic arm plucking canisters off the carrier and placing them on racks. She couldn't stand there all day. She would have the rest of her tour to figure out what was going on in there. She set off again. The first cross passage was double the width of the one she was using, with warning lights as well as mirrors at the corners. Esme glanced at the mirrors, even though the lights were green. Far down the inboard side, something large and lumpy with flashing yellow lights sat motionless, with little dark figures swarming over it. She blinked, startled again at the distances inside this ship. Esme almost missed the second cross corridor. A dark slit opened on either side, barely one pedestrian wide, and lit only by wide-spaced lights. Again she stopped and peered at it. On a cramped escort, this might be a normal width, but it didn't fit with the others she'd seen. The third aft was the most normal so far, if anything about this ship was normal. Three could have walked abreast if they didn't mind banging hands now and then. Evenly spaced hatches opened off it on either side. The fourth aft was much like it, a passage that might have been on any ship save for its length. The fifth, the one she'd come to see, she turned inboard. Forming Workshop A was right where both Patak's cube and the ship's own schematics said it should be. Esme wasn't sure what a forming workshop was, but she could tell that it was important. Guidelines for robotic carts streaked the floor, curving into one hatch after another. Through the open hatches, she could see long arrays of equipment that meant nothing to her. Cylinders and inverted cones, racks of nozzles mounted overhead on tracks, great blank-faced cubes with warning logos on them. Ahead of her, the passage ended in a sealed hatch. Esme glanced again at her notes. The ship's computer evidently thought this passage continued. And perhaps it did, past the obstruction. No admittance without authorization, in yellow on red. And Esme suspected that some of the little gleaming knobs on the hatch seal were actually video sensors. She retraced her way to the longitudinal passage and followed the indirect path suggested by Patak's cube. It took longer than she'd expected. She kept being surprised at the size, and annoyed with herself for still being surprised. But she found Forming Workshop B where Patak's cube said it would be, and on this side the obstruction looked like an ordinary hatch with the label Dye Storage. Esme glanced at her hand comp. Almost late. She would have to hurry, and she was on the other side of the ship from territory she was already thinking of as home. She didn't bother to compare Patak's data with the ship's own this time. She jogged forward on the port side main passage, back around the hub passage, popped into the first passenger tube, and fetched up at her assigned mess only just in time. Here, she found that lieutenants were expected to head a table of jigs and ensigns. She had met none of them yet. They introduced themselves politely, and she tried to sort out names and faces. She said little, listening to them and hoping to find out something to make them memorable. The light-haired ensign on the left had a scrape on his left hand. Surely by the time it healed, she'd have another reason to know him. The jigs seemed a bit stiff, as if they were afraid of her. They must have heard about the court-martial, but was that all?
Lieutenant Sweeza, did you really meet Admiral Serrano?
That was an ensign, not the blonde one, but a thin, dark young man with green eyes. Custis, his name tag said.
Yes, I did.
Ensign Custis opened his mouth to say more, but the blonde ensign elbowed him visibly, and he shut it again. A brief silence followed, during which Esme ate steadily. Out of the corner of her eye, she could see Custis glancing at her from time to time.
You know her grandson's on board, Baron Serrano.
Toby?
That was the blonde. Esme didn't rise to that bait, but she did wonder if coincidence or Serrano influence had anything to do with a young Serrano's assignment. One of the jigs further down the table looked up.
If you'd eat without talking, you wouldn't get your foot in your mouth.
Esme looked up in time to see a look pass from that jig to another one. Something mysterious, which would no doubt end up on her shoulders. She put her fork down. Her appetite had disappeared.
Admiral Serrano's a very interesting person.
That was always safe, she hoped. From the startled looks of the two jigs, perhaps it wasn't.
Not that it wasn't an alarming situation.
Now everyone was looking at her. A year ago, she might have felt her face flushing, but the publicity around the court-martial had taken care of that. She smiled around the table.
Any of you ever served with Admiral Serrano?
No, sir. But she's a Serrano, and they're all pretty much alike.
From his tone, Esme knew exactly what he didn't know. For the first time, she realized she could enjoy this.
I don't think I'd put it that way. Frankly, having served under both of them, Admiral Vita Serrano, that is, and Commander Harris Serrano, I thought them quite individual. Nor is the difference all seniority.
But isn't Commander Serrano, Harris Serrano, that is, the Admiral's niece?
What precisely are you suggesting?
Well, you know, they all stick together. Being related so close, I mean.
Esme had not imagined that kind of prejudice aimed at anyone but fleet outsiders like herself, those who had enlisted from some planet. The Serranos were fleet royalty, one of the 14 private military forces that had combined into the regular space service of the Familius Regnant. If there were serious resentment of the Serranos, and possibly some of the other first 14, someone should know. She should know, and she should not lose her temper and shove this brash youngster's face in the stew. Her temper bucked like one of the green colts in training, and she rode it down, hoping her eyes showed none of the strain.
I think with a little more experience, you won't either think or say things like that, Jig Callison.
Callison turned red and looked down. Conversation naturally died, and she pretended to eat the rest of her dinner. When the senior lieutenant tapped on his glass for attention, Esme felt more relief than curiosity. She found it hard to keep her attention on the announcements of who had the duty and almost missed her introduction. She stood, off balance mentally, if not physically, and nodded to the faces that seemed only pale and dark blurs. After the meal, she left for her quarters as soon as she could. She was annoyed with herself for her immediate prickly response to the mention of the Serrano name and puzzled at her blurry perceptions. Usually, she could focus on new people without much trouble. When she thought about it, she realized that she had actually run about 30 standard hours without sleep. Her transport ship had come in on its own schedule, skewed a full shift and a half from the Kosciusko. Ship lag. Luckily, she never had much trouble with it. One night's sleep seemed to rearrange her internal timer. But right now, she wanted that sleep badly. She wasn't on the watch schedule yet, so she set her personal timer to allow 10 hours. Her compartment filtered out most of the noises. She could just hear the bass thump of someone's music cube. She didn't like it, but it wouldn't keep her awake. She logged off the status board and stretched out on her bunk. She had just time to wonder if she would have nightmares when she fell asleep. Beside her, Pelly leaned out to toss a gas grenade into the passage. A blue line traced the air just above his head, and he jerked back. Esme pressed the filter snugly into her nostrils and peered through the helmet visor. When the smoke obscured normal vision, her helmet sensors gave her a wiggly, false-color view of the corridor. She snaked out into it, hoping that whoever'd been shooting at them didn't have a similar helmet. They thought they'd gotten to the locker before the traitors, but none of the juniors knew how many helmets were supposed to be in that locker. Ahead, someone braced into an angle of a hatch, weapon at ready. Esme couldn't see the features.
Get this bunch of little fuckers and we'll only have Dover to worry about.
She braced her own weapon. The wiggly pink and green image blew apart. Something wet and warm splashed her arm. She ignored it. Through the dense, stinging fog, she slithered on, attention focused on the helmet's input, aware that behind her, Pelly and the others followed, that somewhere, Major Dovir still led the few other loyalist officers. The fog lifted in ragged wisps. Ahead, she could see the scorched lines on the bulkheads. She did not look at the deck, except when she had to, where she would have fallen over obstructions. But even so, she saw them. Heaps of old clothes, dirty and stained, scattered here and there. She would not think of it now. She would not. Later was soon enough. Esme woke in a sweat, heart pounding. Later was now, when she was safe. She turned on her bed light and lay staring at the overhead. They had not been heaps of clothes. She had known it even then. Her father had been all too right. Warfare was ugly, no matter where. Guts and blood and flesh stank the same in a spaceship as in the aftermath of a street riot. And she herself had added to that stench, that ugliness. She and the other juniors had fought their way up the ship onto the bridge, where Dovir, mortally wounded, held the command chair after Hearn was dead. Dovir, his guts slipping out of his hands, had given her that one glazed look, his voice struggling for control, as he gave his last orders. She blinked, trying not to cry. She had cried. It didn't do any good. She felt slimy all over, the sweat cold and slick now, the bedclothes damp and tangled around her. According to the chronometer, she had slept a solid 7 hours. She could try for another short nap, but experience suggested that she wouldn't really sleep. Better would be a shower. It was late third shift on this ship, and an early start on the working day. No one was in the big shower room. She let the hot water warm her and wash away the fear stink. Still, nothing was moving as she came back down the passage. Not her alarm. She had carefully shut hers off. She made it into her compartment before those alarms stopped. When she emerged, it was to find two bleary-eyed ensigns on their way to the showers and a jig leaning on the bulkhead folding down the top flap of his uniform boot.
Sir!
They all came to more or less upright posture. Esme nodded, feeling the momentary glow of virtue that accompanies an early rising, clean teeth, and the evidence that one's associates are still half asleep. She did not let herself dwell on that. She had work to do. Not only learning the ship, as Major Patak had said, but figuring out why the Major's data cube and the ship's records were so different. All that day, except for hurried meals, Esme mapped the real ship against two dissimilar records. Major Patak's data cube was right except once, far in the bow end of T1, Deck 13, when neither fit the reality. A hatch had disappeared completely, replaced by a bulkhead painted in garish stripes. As Esme stood there, wondering what the pattern meant, a bald senior chief bustled out of the nearest cross passage and hurried toward her.
What are you... excuse me, sir. Can I help you find something?
Esme had not missed the tension. Something was clearly going on. But it was not yet her job to find it.
I'm Lieutenant Sweeza. Major Patak told me to familiarize myself with the entire ship by 0800 on the 27th, and I thought there was a hatch up here to the electronics warehouse facility.
Oh, Major Patak. Well, sir, the ship's database hasn't caught up to renovations. The electronics warehouse access is up that way. I'll be glad to show it to you.
Thanks. This bulkhead pattern, is it something they didn't teach us, or...?
It's probably unique to DSR ships, Lieutenant. They're so big, you see. The captain's permitted some non-reg markings to keep newbies oriented.
I see. Very sensible. I've gotten lost several times already.
Most people do, Lieutenant. That pattern just lets people know that what the ship's schematics show isn't there anymore. They haven't gone the wrong way, exactly, but the way's changed.
Esme followed the chief outboard, then forward again, to a hatch clearly labeled Electronics Warehouse Facility. Under that official label was another. Check out with duty, chief, before you remove any parts. This means you. Inside, it looked like any storage facility she'd seen, as large as most on major bases. Racks of containers labeled with part numbers, bins with the most commonly needed parts piled loosely. A jig she had not met yet came out from a warren of racks.
Cher, is that you? Oh, sorry, sir.
Esme went through her explanation again, introducing herself to Jig Forrest. He seemed eager enough to show her the whole warehouse.
I just wondered, my ship schematic showed a different entrance.
Before my time. I know. I got lost trying to find this place when they sent me up from the 14th. We share this warehouse with training. Those technical schools people are always needing more parts in the lab. That's why they moved this warehouse. I don't think they update the ship's schematics often enough, especially since this is a DSR. It's important for us to know where we are. But you know how it is, Lieutenant. No one asks Jiggs for their opinion.
I do indeed. And I suspect, new as my extra bar is, that no one asks lieutenants their opinion either.
You must be with Major Patak. She always sends her new juniors out to find impossible corners of the ship. I've never been in H&A, for which I thank whatever gods govern the assignments.
At least I know where this is now. I'd better get back to my list.
Esme was glad for the years of open country navigation on the Estancia. She had no problem retracing her route down and aft, and arrived in the junior officer's section in plenty of time to freshen up before taking her assigned table at mess. Now that she was wide awake, she found it easier to engage them in conversation. Callison, the senior jig, had a graduate degree in environmental engineering. Partrade, the junior jig, worked in administration, a specialty still called paper pushing, though relatively little of it was on paper. The five ensigns at her table included one in hull and architecture, two in weapons systems, and one each in medical support and data systems. Esme wondered if any of them had served aboard a ship in combat, but didn't like to ask. She had spooked them enough the previous night.
Was the Xavier action your only experience in combat, Lieutenant Tweezer?
Yes, it was.
I've never even served on a warship. I don't think anyone at this table has. They put me in maintenance administration right away, and I've been on the COS for 5 solid years.
I was on checkmate, but we never did anything but patrol.
Be grateful.
Now they all stared at her. Esme hated this. She felt too young and too old at the same time.
If the lieutenant doesn't want to talk about it, don't push her.
That from the lieutenant at the next table, whom Esme now remembered was the one she'd met outside the lift tube.
Dinner's not the time for gory stories anyway.
He winked at Esme. She grinned in spite of herself and turned to her table.
He's right. It's not a fit topic at the table. Or among strangers.
Now she understood why the veterans tended to cluster apart to tell their tales. Why they had fallen silent when she and other juniors had tried to overhear them.
Any of the rest of you have any experience?
Their heads shook.
Well, then we won't be tempted to bring up things like that at dinner. Now, Zintner, you're in H&A. Was that your intent at the academy?
Zintner, who must have stood on tiptoe to make the minimum height requirement, almost sparkled in her seat.
Yes, sir. My family's been in shipbuilding forever. A long time, anyway. I wanted to work on military hulls. That's where the good new stuff is.
And this is your first assignment?
Yes, sir. It's great. You've met Major Patak. She knows so much. And we get to work on everything once we're out with the wave.
My background's scan technology, so I don't know much about H&A. I expect you'll be teaching me a lot.
Me, sir? I doubt it. The Major's got me working on a technical manual right now. She'll probably tell Master Chief Sivers to take you on.
Direct contradiction was rude, but the ensign looked too bouncy to have intended any rudeness. She was simply full of what she was doing. Esme understood that. She turned to the jigs. Callison was pleasantly willing to discuss the less disgusting processes that kept the ship's crew alive and had amusing anecdotes of the sorts of things that went wrong. It had not occurred to Esme that a few insect egg cases caught in the mud in someone's hiking boots could hatch and cause serious problems, but apparently they had on another ship. That story led Partrade to regale them with a story about the time an unnamed junior lieutenant transposed a few numbers and caused a massive overdraft of his ship's account. Everyone had been bumped up 10 grades, so the whole ship was crewed, according to the computer, by officers, and the captain outranked the sector commander. One of the many differences from home that Esme savored was this, that they could talk about their assignments at dinner. On Altiplano, nothing related to one's work could be discussed at dinner, even if all at the table were working together. She found that unnatural. Here, a flurry of shop talk would unwind naturally into other topics.
Are you ready for my exam?
Yes, sir, but I do have a question.
Go ahead.
Why doesn't the ship's schematics agree with reality, or with the schematics on your cube?
Excellent. How many discrepancies did you find?
Esme blinked. She hadn't expected that reaction. She began to describe the discrepancies, starting at the bow and working aft. Patak listened without comment. When she had finished, Patak made a note on her pad.
I believe you found them all. Good work. You asked why we have discrepancies, and that's not a question I can answer. I suspect it's the new AI subroutines, which actively protect data considered especially important. A software glitch, in other words, though we can't seem to convince the fleet system's designers that it's a problem. They take the view that architecture, once launched, shouldn't change, which is probably true for most hulls.
So you create new data cubes individually when you change architecture?
Right. We can actually change the main system for a time, usually an hour or so before it heals itself and repairs what it thinks is a data injury.
But there were two places where your cube didn't match the reality.
I gave you an old data cube, Lieutenant, to see if you'd really check things out. The stupid ones come back all confused, complaining that they can't find their way by ship schematics. The clever ones check out one or two locations, then come back with a list of discrepancies between my cube and the ship schematics. Good, honest officers who aren't afraid of work do what you did. They check everything. That's what I want in my section. People who skip the details in H&A kill ships, and we're here to save them.
Yes, sir.
Esme thought about that. It was an efficient way of separating lazy and careless from diligent and careful, but she wondered what other tricks Major Patak had waiting. It would, she thought, be some exam.
Thank you, sir, for explaining.
Patak looked at her oddly.
Thank you for passing the test, Lieutenant, or hadn't you figured that out yet?
No, sir.
A one-track mind, I wonder, or... Of course. You are a drop squirt.
Drop squirt?
Sorry. DSR vessels develop their own local slang. It means personnel of planetary origin. That's the official term. Someone squirted into deep space work from a drop, a gravity well, and someone junior, which is when you can really tell the difference. One doesn't expect drop squirts to get all the nuances of fleet social structure right away. When did you join, Sweeza?
Prep school, sir.
Esme thought of the years she'd been in a fleet environment. Two in prep school, four in the academy, a tour as ensign, and two assignments as jig. If she hadn't caught on by now, would she ever? She'd thought she had. Her fitness reports always commented on her quiet, mannerly demeanor. What was she doing wrong, besides getting involved in mutinies? Patak gave her a long look.
Technical track, most of the way. You know, Sweeza, we technical types have a reputation for being a little dense in some things. Wouldn't surprise me if you are, too. That doesn't bother me, and won't cause you as much trouble here as it would on a warship. But since you are not from a fleet family, you might want to think about opening your sensors to a little wider band. Just a suggestion, not an order.
Yes, sir.
Esme felt a little dizzy. What was she doing wrong? What was so obvious? She knew that she didn't have an accent anymore. She had tried so hard. But Major Patak had moved to her process chart.
To get you up to speed in H&A, you're going to have to take a couple of quick courses. Right now, all we have is a minor little plate repair job for an escort. It'll be done before you're through with the tapes, and you'll be more used to us then. How are you with tools? Ever done metal fabrication? Ceramics? Or plastics molding?
No, sir.
All right then. Take these tapes down to training and run through them as many times as it takes. Then come back here, and I'll set you up with some instructors. You've got to know how a process is supposed to be done before you can supervise it.
That made perfect sense, and Esme had never minded learning new things. She accepted a thick stack of tapes for the machines.
Yes, sir.
We'll probably be out on deployment before you're through with the tapes. Take what time you need. Sorry, you're naturally thorough. I don't have to warn you against rushing through them.
Sir.
Esme backed out with very mixed feelings. One side of her mind felt ruffled and itchy. Another part felt soothed and confident. Scheduling sessions in training took longer than she had expected.
A DSR needs more specialties than any other kind of ship. And we have to know everything. All the old stuff, and all the new stuff, and anything someone's come up with to make repair easier. Our people are always retraining. The rest of fleet just thinks it retrains, with its predictable little drills every so many days. But we'll get you in, Lieutenant. Don't worry. and Major Patak knows what the situation is, she's not going to blame you.
Nonetheless, it would be 3 standard days before Esme could get a machine, and then only on 3rd shift.
Do you have anything similar that I could go over on my cube reader?
The tech ran the tape titles through her scanner.
Yes, but this is really technical stuff, Lieutenant. What I have on cube is much more basic. The intermediate stuff's all been checked out. In fact, it's overdue.
I'll take the basic. A good review for me.
Esme took the cubes and gave the tech her tapes to be held for her session. Back in her quarters, she inserted the 1st cube. An hour later, she was very glad she hadn't been able to get time on the machines right away. The basic level cube was already past her. She sat back, blinking, and realized she'd have to take it in short doses. Almost lunchtime. She wasn't really hungry, but she did feel stiff and stale. What she wanted was exercise. Esme changed to shorts and padded shoes and followed the directions, in this case identical, given by the ship's schematics and Major Patak's cube to the junior officer's workout area. Aside from being bigger, it was much like the exercise compartments she'd seen on other ships. Rows of machines for exercising this or that group of muscles, enclosed spaces for pair games played on a small court, a large open space with mats for tumbling and unarmed combat practice. Half a dozen or so junior officers occupied various machines, and 2 were sparring on the mats. She checked the charts. At this time of the cycle, only a few machines were reserved. She could use almost anything. Esme avoided the riding simulators and climbed onto something said to simulate cross-country walking on snow. She had no desire to walk on real snow. She had done that. But it was better than pretending to ride horses by sitting on an arrangement of pistons and levers.
Lieutenant Sweezer?
She had just begun to work up her heart rate. When she looked around, it was one of the ensigns from her table, the blonde with the scrape, now healed.
Custis? No, Denton.
I just wondered if you'd talk to our tactics study group about the Xavier affair. Not necessarily your own role, though of course we'd like to hear it, but just how you saw the battle as a whole.
I didn't see the battle as a whole. We got there late, as you may have heard.
Late?
The ship I was on was captained by a...
It was extraordinarily hard to say traitor right out loud to a youngster like this.
Captain Hearn left the Xavier system before the battle. It was only after the... Only after the mutiny, when all the officers senior had died, that I took the ship back.
You... That's like something out of Silver Stars.
Silver Stars?
You know, the adventure game series?
It was nothing like an adventure game.
No, but in the 8th series, when the young lord had to overcome the Wicked Prince and then lead the ships in battle... But...
It's not a game. People get killed for real.
Well, I know that, but in the game...
I'm sorry, I don't play adventure games. I only fight wars.
But will you talk to our tactics group?
Esme thought it over. Perhaps she could make clear the difference between game and reality.
Yes, but I'll have to check my schedule. When do you meet?
Every 10 days. But we could move the meeting time if you wanted.
I'll check. Now, I've got to finish my set.
Detton went away, and Esme worked until she felt she'd worked off not only the stiffness of study, but the unreasonable anger she'd felt at being compared to a gaming hero. By the time she'd cooled down again, she began to think whether she should have been quite so quick to agree, even if she hadn't agreed to a specific time.
Should I talk to a pack of ensigns about the Xavier affair?
If she kept her own part to a minimum and discussed the way Harris Serrano had held off a superior force, surely that could do no harm.